Okay, this morning's lecture is definitely going to be one that is Torah Umada. We're going to be looking at both halachic sources and medical issues. And we are going to be starting with the Mada, giving a little bit of scientific background in terms of the topic that we're getting into. I realize this is a very large lecture hall, but since I'm going to be throwing around a lot of concepts, I will be very happy if at any point I get to a phrase or something that I didn't explain well enough, just raise your hands and I'll clarify. Okay. What you have in front of you is a PowerPoint presentation that was printed out. One of the problems with being a doctor is you're used to having a nice screen where you can put it up nice and big and whatever. I realize in printing it out, some of these things is going to be a challenge for those of us over the age of 40. But we're going to do our best. That includes myself. Okay. On the first page on the top right, you have a picture there of the medical menstrual cycle. And one of the reasons I'm calling this medical menstrual cycle is because as we go on, we're going to be discussing a little bit about the halachic menstrual cycle or things having to do with Hilchot Nidah. What you see here in this picture is the classic presentation of what the menstrual cycle looks like in almost every single medical textbook, and that is that it lasts 28 days. And if you look on the bottom, you'll see a little arrow, which is supposed to show where ovulation takes place, which is on day number 14. As you'll begin to see in the next slide, which is the column on the right, the second one down, in real life, there's a lot more variability. Okay, I brought you there the statistics from two different studies that looked at what the average length of the menstrual cycle is, depending on the age group. And you see that in younger women, the average tends to be a little longer than 28 days. And not only that, if you look at the next column, the SD, the standard deviation, that means that they're about 4 days in each direction. So, you know, that could be 26 days, that could be 34 days. And in fact, by medical definition, anything from 21 to 35, or if you read other textbooks, 21 to 42 days, is considered a completely normal menstrual cycle. So why does 42? Okay. So why do textbooks always say 28? Because doctors are not always that smart. 28 divides nicely into 4 equal weeks, and that makes it very easy to talk about. Okay, in the next 3 slides that you have in front of you, I bring in various artificial hormones. Okay, we're going to get back to these slides a little bit more as we progress to go into the details, but just to give a little bit of introduction, once about going back to that first slide, which talks about the medical menstrual cycle, we see that there are 2 hormones that have big influence in the menstrual cycle, one of which is estrogen. For those of you that can really read the tiny print, it says E2 there. And you'll see that at the beginning of the menstrual cycle, the E goes up a little bit, dips down a little bit in the middle, and goes back up again. That slight dip down is what triggers the hypothalamus, the bottom of our brain, to actually start the ovulation. And you'll also see a little letter P. The little letter P stands for progesterone, which tends to be higher in the second half of the menstrual cycle, support the uterine lining, and when it starts going down, that's when we have the beginning of menstruation. Okay, we're now on page number 2. If you look on the right-hand column in the middle, I have here a slide that says halachic uses of hormones. And this is why we are having this shiur as part of Midrashet Yom Rishon and not as an introduction to, you know, how your body grows up when you're in fifth grade. And that is that there are certain times that we have halachic issues that are raised by the menstrual cycle. Okay, we have the whole overall issue of Hilchot Nidah, which we're going to get into in great depth as we go on. But there's certain times where we have a tendency to want to change the natural menstrual cycle for halachic purposes, one of which is the issue of Chupat Nidah. Okay, if a woman would get married at the time that she would be Nidah, it would be impossible for the couple to have relations on their wedding night. And while this is not a halachic problem, because they will in fact still be married, it's not necessarily what most people are dreaming about before their wedding night. And therefore, there is a tendency to want to prevent chupat nida, okay? Prevent a woman being in nida at the time of her wedding. Okay, I'll keep referring to that as preventing chupat nida. And the second issue that comes up is the issue of halachic infertility. Okay? Now, what is halachic infertility is when we looked at that nice 28-day cycle, okay? And if we had a woman who had 5 days of menstruation and then has 7 more days before she can go to the mikveh for reasons we're going to see in great depth during the rest of this year, she would be going to the mikveh on day number 12, she would be ovulating on day number 14, and things would just be perfect. Okay? In fact, that looks so good on paper that often when you see essays that are written to try to encourage women to in fact keep Hilchot Nida, to in fact keep the laws of the mikveh, you will see sometimes written how wonderful the system is, because it's worked out perfectly that at the time she's going to the mikveh, she is most likely to conceive. But that's only for those women who read the book that said they were supposed to ovulate on day 14 and have a 28-day cycle, not for the ones who have an exception. And part of those exceptions can in fact be women who are going to the mikveh on day 14 and ovulating on day 12. And what is going to result from that is a situation called either halachic infertility or religious infertility, where from a medical perspective, a woman is perfectly fertile, there's nothing the matter with her, there's nothing the matter with her husband, but the only reason that the couple is not conceiving is because of a timing mismatch between mikveh immersion and therefore the ability to have relations and the time of her natural ovulation. So we can play with it, okay? We can change it. And we can use artificial hormones to move things along. Exactly how to do it, we're going to come back to as we come on. The question is, should we? Okay? Why not? Okay, sounds great. Okay, we have the way to intervene medically to be able to solve this halachic problem. And the answer is, like many things, medications are not necessarily benign. Okay, medications have side effects. And if you look on the page we're on now, page number 2 on the top right, I list a number of known side effects of hormones, of using artificial estrogen and progesterone. I also list the sources from where I got these, so if anyone wants to go and look it up, you know, in greater depth. These are known risks, okay? Number one, there's a risk, and any kind of disease that has to do with extra coagulation, with blood clots, happens more to women who are using hormones. This includes heart attacks, which is basically when you end up getting a blood clot in the blood supply to your heart. This includes stroke, which is getting a blood clot in the blood supply to your brain. This includes pulmonary embolism, which means getting a blood clot in the blood supply to your lungs. Okay, and all these things are known to be more. Okay, twice the risk of non-users for heart attacks, 2 to 5 times the incidence of stroke for women who are using it as opposed to non-users, pulmonary embolism. Now, saying it like that sounds awfully, awfully scary. The only thing is, though, you have to know what numbers we're talking about to begin with, okay? If the risk of something is approximately 1 in 100,000, and that's the ballpark figure we're talking about, double the risk means 2 in 100,000. Now, that is double, okay? But it's still relatively rare. So how exactly one looks at those statistics depends on how exactly one is thinking about risk and how much risk one is willing to take. Now, what in the world does risk of hormones have to do with halacha? Okay, why am I standing up here, not at a medical conference, but at a Midrashei Yom Rishon talking about that? And that is because risk is a halachic issue. All right, and if you have really good eyes and look at the top on the left, under the slide that says health, I brought in a number of, don't worry, I'm also going to say it out loud. I brought in a number of sources that talk about this issue of preventative health or caring for yourself and why we have a halachic obligation to be concerned for our own safety. Now, a lot of times when we talk about safety, the first thing that pops to people's mind, okay, is the Uncle Moshe song about "Vinishmartem ol nafshotecha." Okay? Which is true, which is good, but if you look that verse up in context, that's not the pshat of the pasuk. There is, however, though, a plain, straightforward, deoraita pasuk that talks about safety, and that is Dvarim Kafbet Chet, okay? Dvarim 22:8, which goes, Ki tivne bayit chadash, v'asita ma'akel gagecha, v'lo tasim damim b'beitecha, ki pol hanofel mimenu. When you are building a new house, you have to make a fence around the roof, and you have to do this to prevent there being bloodshed from your house in case anybody falls down from it. Okay? Straightforward verse from the Torah. And lest you think that this is talking just about a roof specifically, or lest you think that it would be sufficient to like put a string around the roof like we put an eruv or something like that, if you look in the Shulchan Aruch, okay, Yoredei Akuf Tetzayin, you will see that this pasuk is understood by halacha to referring to any kind of health risks. It's not only a roof, it's also having a pit, it's also having a dangerous dog in your house, it's also having anything that can be risk. And it says, "V'ken kol mechshol sheyesh bo sakanat nefashot." Any kind of pitfall that has the possibility of endangering a life, mitzvat asei lahasiro, we have a positive commandment to get rid of it, v'lehishamer mimenu, and to avoid it, v'im lo hisir, and if you didn't get rid of it, v'hiniach mechsholot ha-mevi'im lidei sakana, and you left these pitfalls that could lead to danger, bitel mitzvat asei, you've done a double whammy. You have gotten rid of a positive commandment, okay, of asita ma'akel gagecha, that's a positive commandment, ve'avar belotasim damim. And you also have gone over the negative, you've transgressed the negative commandment of not having bloodshed from your house. Okay? And if we also quote the Rambam, ho'il v'heyot haguf bari v'shalei midarkei Hashem hu, that having a whole and healthy body is one of the ways of Hashem. Shehare iafshar sheyavin oyeda davar mi divrei habore shehu chole. Because it's impossible for you to appreciate God. It's impossible for you to worship God if you are in fact sick. Lefichach tzarich lehachik adam atzmo midvarim hamavdim et haguf. Therefore, we have to take ourselves away from things that can possibly destroy our bodies. And we are supposed to do, in fact, healthy and healthful practices. Okay? And the Rambam actually mentions such things as getting enough sleep, exercising, eating healthy. He was way ahead of his times. Okay, so this issue of having some sort of risk involved in a medication is a halachic issue. Okay? Even more so, if the whole reason that we are going ahead and using this medication is to try to deal with an issue that is raised by a halachic situation. Now, this potential clash between a halachic obligation, okay, a halachic rules for which we're using the hormones, and a halachic obligation to prevent risks, actually became a very large debate in Israel about 2.5 years ago. Okay, there was a obstetrician who was trying to say that we should totally redo all of Hilchos Nida, so we never need to use any of these hormones. If we would go back into doing Hilchos Nida on a Torah level, we wouldn't have this problem, and we should go ahead and do it. I would argue that I think he went a little bit too far. And there are, in fact, things that we can do within the halachic system, as it is practiced today, that can prevent many of these cases and minimize the need to use this artificial hormonal intervention. And that's what we're going to look at in depth now. We're starting on page number 2. Left-hand side bottom, I'm giving you now the overview of what I call the halachic menstrual cycle. And then we'll look at the various sources to understand each of these various steps. Okay? If we would look at it medically, we tend to start the cycle from the onset of menses, so halachically we're going to start it from the onset of the nida status, although we have to keep in mind that while menstruation is the most common reason for a woman to become nida, it's not the only one. A woman can become nida if she's having breakthrough bleeding while she's on artificial hormones, even though that's not considered a period. A woman can become nida if she's having some bleeding at the beginning of pregnancy, which is definitely not menstruation. Okay, there are all kinds of things that can make a woman nida, the most common of which is the beginning of her menstrual cycle. The next thing that has to happen is that she has to show that all of the bleeding and the staining has in fact stopped. That's done by an internal examination known halachically as a hefsek tahara. There has to be a minimum of 5 days that go by that the end will understand five. The four is in parentheses, because there are some Sephardic traditions that have a 4-day minimum rather than a 5-day minimum, but just for the simplicity, I'm going to keep saying five. And she has to go through a time frame of 7 days during which she has had no bleeding or staining, generally known as the Shiva Nakim. Okay, so where do we know about this whole cycle from? We start to know it from the Psukim, which are in the right-hand column on the bottom. Okay, that's one of the verses that we have in the Torah. You have it translated here, that if a woman has a flow, she will be nida for 7 days. 7 days. Not 12 days, 7 days. That's what it is on a Torah level. And sometimes women ask the question, wait a second. This is talking about Tuma and Tara. This is talking about ritual impurity. And there are lots of other ritual impurities that are listed there. How come it's only us that have to keep them? All right? And the answer to that question is in the next pasuk, and that is because the nida is not only listed as one of the things that have to do with tumah v'tahara, ritual impurity, it's also one of the things that are listed in terms of what are forbidden sexual relationships. Ve'el isha b'nida tumata lo tikarev legalot erva. Okay? That you should not approach a woman who is nida for sexual purposes. And that's why this is still applicable today. Now, from these verses, we're now on page number 3, top left-hand column. Isha ki ez zava, dam ye zova b'psara, shivat yamim tiye v'nidata. Okay, that's the verse that we just went through before, the first of the two verses that I quoted. V'lamdu chachamim midrash ha-psukim, and our sages learned from the exegesis of these verses, shelo b'kol makom shetazuv mimenu dam tmeya, that not any kind of bleeding can make a woman nida, but only bleeding that actually comes from the uterus. And not any kind of bleeding that comes, but one that is from five very specific colors, as we'll see. And even in these specific things, she only becomes nida on a Torah level if she has something called hargasha. Okay? So, just to summarize the three things that we've talked about before, in order to become nida on a Torah level, it has to be uterine bleeding, it has to be of a specific prohibited color, and it's only in a case where she had hargasha. Now, next slide over on the right-hand side, what is hargasha? The answer is, good question. All right? While it's a very important halachic principle, it actually has not necessarily been spelled out in the best possible terms. However, a number of descriptions that have been culled from various parts of halacha include, number one, her whole body shakes. Number two, she feels her uterus open. And number three, she feels liquid flowing. Now, most of the women here in the audience look like they're post-pubertal and have probably been through a number of menses in their lives and are probably wondering, whole body shake? What you talking about? Don't worry, you're normal, okay? These sensations, this hargasha, is very rare, okay? I have yet to meet the woman who talks about her whole body shaking. I have met one or two women who will swear to me that they know exactly when their menses are starting. They actually feel their uterus open. And the issue of feeling some sort of liquid flowing, that's a more common sensation that women have, though not necessarily at the total beginning. But in summary, her gush is actually relatively rare. However, all that has to do, what Hargasha just means on a Torah level. Because there might be a situation that women are a little bit busy with other things in their life, and maybe having the Hargasha and not realize it, the Chachamim decided that a woman would be nidah from any uterine bleeding, even without Hargasha. And this we see on the slide in the middle on the left. Dvar Torah, Ein ha'isha mit'ama v'lo asura lebala, al shetargish yeseh hadam b'bzara. V'chachamim gazru al kol ketem shenimtza b'gufa u'b'gadeha, shehit me'a v'asura lebala, afilo shelo hergisha, afilo batkatma v'matza teora. Okay, that there is a rabbinic decree that a woman becomes nida when she has a uterine flow, even without hargasha. So that applies to most of what happens in real life. However, these same Rabbanan who made this decree put in caveats. And the caveats are the next two slides. Number one, the size of the stain that she finds. Lo gazru al ketam elam ken yeh kegris ve'od gris. She'em b'zeh k'shi'ur hanachnu tolim lomar dam kinahu. That if it is less than the size of a grease, approximately the size of a U.S. penny, it doesn't count. Okay? It does not make her be nida by definition. Doesn't matter where she finds it, how she finds it, what color it is. If it's that small, it just this rabbinic decree does not apply. The surface on which it's found. Ketem shenimtzal davar she'eino mekabel tuma lo gazru aleha. If it's found on something that does not take ritual impurity, it does not count. The color of the surface, v'ketem hanimtzal beged savua, ubektamim shomim akel, that if she finds it on a colored garment, it does not count. The location found, lo b'kol makom shimseh ketem tmeya eladaf makom shefshar she'evol mehamakor. If she finds a stain on her shoulder, okay, this is not going to make her nida, unless she happens to be doing acrobats. Okay? And the Gemara actually says that. Okay? And if there's any other possible explanation, im yesh ba makab gufa sheyachola letzlok ba sheefshar sheyavo hatam mimeno tola, if it is possible that she was bleeding from something else, that she had a nosebleed, she cut her finger, she was taking care of her kid who had a nosebleed or cut her finger, okay? Then we can assume that the stain comes from that and it does not make her nida. Okay? Now these caveats are important because I think you can start imagining how we can put them to use. Okay? If we know that a stain that happens on something colored does not make a woman nida, then she could wear colored. Okay? And if we know, okay, that's probably the easiest example to deal with. Now sometimes women say, oh, but isn't that cheating? Okay? I know I'm staining, I'm putting on color, that's just, you know, how can I do that? And the answer is in what we just learned here, okay? The same rabbis that made the decree that said without hargasha, without the halachically relevant sensation, she was going to be nida, put in the caveats. Therefore, if we are having a chachamim, if we are believing in the chachamim to take upon ourselves this broadened definition of nida, then we should be believing them to take the caveats that they themselves put in. Okay, so this is definitely not cheating. This is legitimate, and this can definitely be used. Over on the right, bottom slide, I have a list of chamisha damim tmeim biyisha, adom v'hashachor v'kikeren hakakom v'kimei adama u'kimazug. These are the five specific shades that on a Torah level would have made a woman nida. Okay? Red, and not any red, but specifically the kind of red that would come from the kind of blood that comes out of your finger if you cut it. Black, like the crocus flower. black is its own thing, the red of a crocus flower, the red of the color of the earth, but not any color of the earth, specifically the earth that comes from the valley of Beit Kerem, and like diluted wine, and not just any wine, but wine that has already been diluted 2/3 of Shiryoni wine. Okay? Don't worry, I'm not testing you on those specific things. But I want you to see how specific it is, because today on a Rabbanan level, today on a rabbinic level, we take any shade of red, but saying any shade of red makes a woman nida is already putting in a big safety net. Okay? And therefore, when there's an issue about a specific color, such as browns, is it red? Is it not red? And sometimes women are saying, like, I went to the Rav, I know I have the stain, and it's brown, how could it be okay? And he told me it's okay. The answer is, because there's already a big safety net built in there, and therefore there is room for leniency in other colors as well, especially in situations where we're dealing with a halachic problem such as possibly having a chupat nidah, such as halachic infertility. Okay? There's room there for maneuverability because there's already a large safety net. Okay, so we talked already about the issue of nidah d'oraita, nidah on a Torah level, and nidah d'rabbanan. The next issue that has to do with why we keep nidah the way we do right now has to do with two different halachic statuses, one that of the nidah and one that of the zavah. If you remember our original verse that we brought in at the beginning, we said that a woman is nidah for 7 days. Okay? If it was 7 days, I wouldn't be having so many problems of ovulation on day 12, 13, 14. So what's the big deal? And the big deal is because there is another halachic status mentioned in the sources, and that is zava. What's the difference between them? If we look at page number 4, top left, v'zemishpata, I'm talking now about the nida, mishetereti padam afilu kechardal o pochot bo, ben ba'onis ben baratzam, monah sheva yamim, im yom riata, v'tovelot b'leil chet. Okay? That if she started becoming a nida, she simply counts until the 7th day, where the day that she saw was the first day, the night that followed the 7th day, that's when she went to the mikvah. On the other hand, Isha ki azov, I'm now on slide number, the one on the right, Isha ki azov, zov dama yamim rabim below eight nidata, o ki tazov al nidata, kol yamei zov tumata ki mei nidata tiyet me'ahi. Ve'im Torah mizova, v'sifra la shiv'at yamim ve'achar titar. That if a woman enters the state of zava, which means that either she had a prolonged episode of bleeding, she bled for more than 7 days, which is what we would expect from the nida, or she bled at a time that we were not expecting her to be bleeding at all, she enters the status of zava. What happens with a zava? That we have to add these 7 days. It's actually a little bit more complicated that if we look at source number 3, which is the middle one, on the left, miyom zayin ve'elech mishpata behen imrata behem yom echad levad v'zoti shenikra shomeret yom keneged yom. That if she had like one extra day or one unexpected day, all she would have to do is add one more day. Okay, one extra day where she had no bleeding, and then she could go to the mikveh. If she bled for 2 unexpected days, she would also have to add one more day. However, if she bled 3 days, then we need 7 clean days. Okay, we need the Shiva Nekiyim, we need these whole extra 7 days. I'm sorry? What's expected, what's not expected? If a woman is having her menses at the time she expects to have it, okay, the following 11 days are days that are unexpected. So if she has any bleeding during that 11th day time frame, you have to be very careful using the word period here. Okay, so during that time frame, she has any bleeding, that's in the Zava category. It could either be that she bled for 8 days in a row, or it could be that she bled for 4 or 5 days, and then somewhere in that 11-day pause, she had bleeding. Okay? Now, I think you can start to see how this is getting a little complicated, and also partially because in order to know when one starts to be a nida, you have to be sure that that day makes you nida on a Torah level. Because if you're not nida, and you count that as day number one, and you add 6 days to go on the seventh day at night, but you really only became nida the next day, you went to the mikveh a day early on the Torah level. Okay? Does that make sense? In other words, those specific colors, which on the one hand we are broadening to prevent the possibility of somebody not knowing exactly what color it is, that rabbinic decree to broaden them had a potential side effect that you might go to the mikveh too early. You know, something that was meant to be more stringent could lead to a real leniency on a Torah level. So to prevent that possibility, the first thing that happens on the left on the bottom, Hitkin Ravi Basadot, Rata Yomachate Shevala Shishavahu. If she only had one unexpected day, she added 6 days. Okay? Which covered both possibilities. Because adding 6 days plus one, I got to seven. If that one day was really Nida, I went on time. And if that day was really Zava, I added 5 extra days because I really only had to add one. Yes? Okay. By most styles of count, you mean you count starting the 7 days? I understand. Right. Okay. Because in this case, she only bled for 1 day. All her bleeding was 1 day. Okay? So if she added... Oh, I think what you're a little confused about is if we were doing the Dana Torah level, we have to know what the seventh day is. Not adding 7 days like we do today, but the seventh day of the Nida. So in order to know what my seventh day is, I have to start counting on the first day. Okay? Part of what makes this confusing is I'm busy describing something that nobody is doing, because that's not the way we keep the halacha at this point. But the reason I'm doing this is because in order to understand what we can do halachically, we have to know what it used to be. Okay? So if we're back on a doraita level, you know, do not do this at home. All right? This is for explanation purposes only. Then I'm counting from when I start. And in that case, if I only bled for 1 day and I added 6 days, I'm fine. Okay? Miman of shach, as they say in Gemara. Either this way or that way, I'm okay. Same thing if she bled for 2 days and I added 6 days. I'm covered in both directions. Yes? Pain is not considered hagasha. Okay? Pain is not considered hagasha. Cramps are not considered hagasha. Back pain, feeling like you want to kill your husband and children, all of that is not considered hagasha. It may, however, count as another halachic concept called veser haguf. Okay, this is not a whole shiur having to do with Hilchot Nida, but one of the other issues that comes up in keeping Hilchot Nida is when you are expecting to become Nida, which days you observe, and for women who have very specific signs and symptoms of when this is going to happen, they may be able to rely on those signs and symptoms as opposed to just relying on counting the days. But good question. Okay, so we're back to this Hitkin Rebbe Basadot, adding 6 extra days. And if she bled for 3 days in a row, then she would add 7. Okay? Because there, either way, if she was Nida, she has to, there by definition, she has to be a Zava, because she had 3 days in a row, so she has to keep the 7 days. That was Rebbe's way of dealing with it, which was still very confusing. And at that point, the women said, the heck with it, I'm not going to take count when I'm doing 6 days, when I'm doing 7 days. I'm doing 7 days all the time. And that's what we have on the bottom on the right. Amar Rabbi Zera, Benot Yisrael hechmiru al atzman, she'afilu ro'ot tipat dam kechardal yoshvot aleha sheva nekiyim. That the daughters of Israel were stringent on themselves and decided in all cases they were going to add 7 days. Now I went through this whole process to show you that we are not responsible for adding 7 days. At the very least, we're responsible for adding 1 extra day, and that was to prevent confusion. Okay, now if you remember back at the beginning when I was talking about how sometimes we try to encourage keeping Hilchot Nida by saying how she is going to go to the mikveh on day number 12, okay, because she put on these 7 extra days, you have to see the top slide on the left, that this whole issue of adding the 7 extra days is not the way it was meant to be. Okay, this is something that came out of the necessity of exile, out of the necessity of losing a tradition to be able to figure out exactly when one became nidah. As the Torah says, Misharabu hagaluyot, v'tatfu hasarot, v'nematu halavavot. Okay, when they were in galus for a long time and there were all kinds of problems and people just couldn't do things as well as they did before, chashu shema yavol litzot b'yisur karet. They were afraid that a woman may end up doing a very serious transgression. Shema tire isha b'mei nidata shisha yamim, v'yu kol hadam tohar. That she's bleeding for 6 days, but these 6 days really did not make her a nidah because they were not those forbidden colors. Ubashri'i shemarata adam tameh. And it was only on the 7th day that she saw that she was in fact having the prohibited bleeding. And she went to the mikvah the night of the 7th day. 6 days, 5 days or 6 days too early. So that's when they decided to broaden the definition and say it has to do with any red. They shouldn't mix up between whether she's a nida and ziva, because to try to keep track your entire life. Now wait, is this the 7 days or the 11 days or the 7 days or the 11 days? Hosifu chumra chara chumra ad she'amru she'afilu im lo tireh afilu tipadam kechardal teshevah le'ashivah nekiyim kizavah gdola. That the way we practice it today is anytime a woman enters the nida status, she is always tacking on an extra 7 days after all her bleeding has stopped. In addition to that, we have another series of gezerot, which I'm not going to go into their development, because that really only works with the blackboard. And that is that we have that 5-day minimum. Okay, I'll just say that the 5-day minimum is connected to the possibility that a woman may have expelled some semen during the time that she was in the Shiva Nekiyim, which would require her to add on an extra day. And to prevent that possibility happening, they made it there's a 5-day minimum, or as I said in some Sephardic traditions, a 4-day minimum. So if you take the 5, and you take the extra 7, and you put them together, we end up with the minimum, the earliest time that a woman today can go to the mikveh is on the night following day number 12. Now if you look at the left-hand column in the middle, you see this graph. This comes from a study by Dr. Yaakov Levy in the 1970s, where he sat down and he calculated that depending on the length of a woman's cycle, you could end up with a situation where a woman is going to the mikveh after she's ovulated. All right, on the left-hand side, you have the numbers that are the length of her cycle. Okay, as we go up the chart, she has a longer and longer cycle. Starts here from 22 and goes through 36. Okay, and the black days that are on this chart are her fertile days. Those are days that she could get pregnant. And he has the women using the mikveh on day number 12. I'm sorry, he has ovulation on day number 14, that line down the middle. So you see that the women with the longer cycle are doing fine, okay, because they're going to the mikveh after ovulation. But the women with the shorter cycle are missing ovulation, okay? This is the first medical description of this situation known as halachic infertility. And the reason that it waited until the 1970s is because it wasn't until like the middle of the 1900s that we actually understood how the female menstrual cycle worked. Okay, so people were unaware of this entity till, it's hard to say this, but the last century. Okay, and if you look at that, you see it might be a common situation. In fact, that obstetrician that I mentioned before at the beginning was saying 25% of women are affected by this, because if you figure out the length of women's menstrual cycles, 25% of women have cycles that are shorter than 24 days. The only problem is that, once again, that's not reality. Okay, reality is that Not only do not all women read the book about having a 28-day cycle, not all women read the book that they're supposed to ovulate 14 days before their next cycle. Okay, that's how they come out, that ovulation is on day 14, because the second half of the cycle is supposed to be relatively relatively consistent from woman to woman, that it's 14 days before her next cycle, that's when she's ovulating. Some books will give a little bit of leeway and says it's not really 14, it's 12 to 16, but it's relatively consistent. But if you look at the slide in the middle on the right, all right, this was another study that was going on in the 1970s. Some guy who just loved getting data, okay, and you have to remember he also got this data before they invented the computer, so he was doing this entire study by hand, gave hundreds of women menstrual diaries to keep over numbers of years, went through approximately 5,000 cycles, and was able to determine when women were ovulating based on having them take their temperature in the morning, basal body temperature, is one of the ways to decide when ovulation happens. And he showed that, I'll give you one extreme example, if you look on the top column where you have women who have cycles less than 19, okay, and you say, okay, these women will never get pregnant because they must be ovulating on day 4, okay, even going back to a Torah level is not going to help this woman, but 30% of those women actually ovulated on day 15 or greater. Okay, across the top is the day of ovulation, across the side is the number of days of the cycle. So yes, there are some women with short cycles who are ovulating too early, but you cannot decide that a person is ovulating too early just on the length of her cycle. To further back that up with more recent data, on the bottom on the left, okay, this is a study that was published in 2006 where they gave women lots of menstrual diaries, and in this case checked whether she was ovulating by using what's called testing for LH, which is one of the hormones that happen right before the LH surge. LH goes up right before ovulation, and they actually tested it, and they showed there's a tremendous variability in women in how long their cycle is. Like if you ask somebody how long is your cycle, and she says 26 days, but you actually measure it over a number of months, you will see that it could be, there's a week difference. Some months it'll be 22 days, some months it'll be like 30 days, you know, it can go like a number of days in each direction, which can make a real difference in terms of when she's ovulating, you know, depending on that particular month. And that's talking to women who will say, I have a regular cycle that I always, you know, ovulate on day 26 or 27 when you actually test it. I'm not saying not ovulate, I always get my period on day 26 or 27, that in reality it changes a lot. So getting back to how we're going to handle and prevent and deal with this issue of halachic infertility before we even get to putting in those hormones that might have those potential risks which are a halachic issue, I would argue that women who think they have halachic infertility should check when they are ovulating. Okay? Checking when you're ovulating is not that complicated. One possibility is taking the basal body temperature, which means before you get out of bed in the morning after you've actually slept for 4 hours in a row, putting a thermometer in your mouth and measuring your temperature and documenting it. And for those of us who live lifestyles that never happens, there are fortunately other methods such as, you know, on the next page you have a picture of one of those LH kits that I was just telling about. And one can also tell if a woman is ovulating by ultrasound, okay? I just think it's a major pain in the neck to have to go to the doctor on a daily basis to do an ultrasound. So for most women, the issue of doing the home LH surge would work. They're reasonably, you know, accurate. If we're talking about a case of a woman who's about to go in vitro fertilization, then they may want to have it confirmed by ultrasound. But in the average case, the things would work. Yes? No. I'm sorry, repeat the question. She asked about the issue of cervical mucus. In addition to the basal body temperature, okay, there are other physical signs of knowing when you're ovulating having to do with the changes of cervical mucus. So a woman who is trained, okay, to know the differences in their cervical mucus can use that method as well. It just requires actually being trained in doing it, which is taking your temperature is a little bit easier to explain. It doesn't necessarily make a woman nidah because the way you're supposed to check it is actually on the outside of your body. And if you check it on the outside of your body without putting anything in internally, it shouldn't make you nidah. Okay? Okay, so that's, first of all, it's very important to know that the diagnosis is correct. Second of all, the first time that people started noticing that women were having difficulty with pregnancies was in the previous century, and we have, and this is in the middle on the left, a number of tshuvot of how we can deal with this. Okay, we have a tshuva of Dad Cohen, which was Rav Kook. You have a tshuva of the Abiya Omer, which is Rav Avadya Yosef. You have a big article in Noam. You have a tshuva of the Har Tzvi. You have the Igrot Moshe, Rav Moshe Feinstein, and you also have the Tzitz Eliezer. And pretty much what they dealt with, the solution that they proposed, was shortening the five-day minimum. Okay? Since that was based on a rabbinic decree, and one could argue that the rabbinic decree was not meant to apply in cases where infertility was a concern, there's room to be able to shorten it in certain situations. Each one proposes slightly different ways to get around it. I'm not going to go into the specific details between them. The only problem is that only works if you have a very short menses, okay? If you really are bleeding for 5-6 days, which is completely normal, that's not going to solve your problem. So the next thing that started helping in terms of solving the problem was using medical intervention. In the middle on the right, you have a list of the various articles that have discussed this. The first article was also published in the 1970s. However, it was published in HaRefuah in Israel in Hebrew, so I don't think anyone ever read it. In which he proposed that if you give estrogen early in the cycle, you can delay ovulation. Now, if you go back to the first page, okay, where I had that medical menstrual cycle, we're going to explain how this works. Okay? If you're looking on the top and you see a dotted line that sort of has two humps, that's the estrogen. By giving external estrogen at the beginning of the cycle, you can make that first hump last a little bit longer. When you stop taking the estrogen, the level goes down, and it's actually the going down in the level of estrogen that clues your body to do the LH surge and the process of ovulation. Okay, so giving external estrogen was shown to delay ovulation. The only problem is in the first studies that they did, giving extra estrogen also has a tendency of giving a lot of breakthrough bleeding, which then makes you need that in itself, and you're back where you started from. Over time, they try things to be a little bit more sophisticated, and by using lower doses of estrogen, by using the kinds of estrogen that is usually used for hormone replacement therapy for dealing with menopausal symptoms, in many cases you are able to give that hump longer so your body ovulates later, but not getting to breakthrough or withdrawal bleeding, and it works, okay? The second article, I believe, there is a series, a case series of 26 women where they have used this, and it worked. Another person tried another idea. Well, another place that we have artificial hormones available to use is in birth control pills. And in fact show that if you give combination hormones, okay, it's hard to say, you can't say birth control pills anymore because it's now also the birth control patch and the birth control ring and all kinds of things like that. But if you give combination contraceptives for a few days at the beginning of the cycle, it also raises the estrogen level, keeps it up, and causes ovulation later, and that can work. Another drug that is used sometimes for this purpose is clomiphene, which is sort of this artificial estrogen, fools your body into thinking it's estrogen and causes you to ovulate later. And like I said, they work, but they have, you know, they have potential risk to them. Okay, back to where we were before. The other hormone that we have available in the case of preventing chupat nidah is progesterone. Okay? One of the things that one can do if one feels that the menstrual, a woman is going to end up being a dad at a wedding, it was planned wrong, or she's completely irregular, is simply put her on the birth control pill for a couple of months before. You're taking total control of the cycle, and you can then decide when she'll, you know, when she will in fact have her period, and you can time it that it'll be after her wedding. Another possibility is to give progesterone, okay, if you remember the second hump there with the P, if you give some artificial progesterone and you keep that hump going longer, you can push off her menses for a number of days. Okay, that doesn't really help us in the halachic infertility situation, but it can help us in the chupat nida situation. So to get back to my, you know, my original premise here, that we have on the one hand a halachic reasons for using these hormones, on the other hand, some risk involved in using them and a halachic obligation to avoid risk when possible, my argument would be as follows, that first one has to start with the halachic interventions, okay? Halachic interventions mean things like wearing colored underwear, okay, as we described. That doesn't make, you know, if it doesn't make you need that, then it's not a problem. Using other things related to a having it be on a non-tuma getting surface. Using those caveats, making sure to ask that she's actually nida, because a lot of women, as soon as they see anything that's not clear white or, you know, light yellow, say, oh, I must need nida, and add on an extra day or two. And just getting rid of that unnecessary day or two is very likely to solve the problem. And I, you know, working as a Yoeset Halakha, where women were asking thousands of questions in this area, my sense was that a lot of times, no one was checking if she was really nida. She'd go to the doctor would put her on medication, with just based on her word. And we did actually a survey of 40 doctors. Okay, so we say, okay, women don't want to ask the question, but if they go to the doctor must be finding out if she's really nida. And out of the 40 doctors that answered the questionnaire, not a single one said the first thing that I would do is talk to the Rav to make sure that she's really nida. All right, so I think that if we would, A, diagnose the situation correctly, we would already get rid of about 25% of the cases. If we would apply the halachic interventions to make sure that she's not nida longer than she is, we would get rid of another 25% of the situation cases. And in that case, we're only using the medication when it's really, really needed, and therefore, while we might be not be eliminating the risk, we're certainly reducing it. Okay, I have a few seconds here if anyone wants any more questions. Okay, so it's the whole issue of whether some, the question was what fabrics do not accept tuma. And there is some halachic debate, but most opinions are that if it's on some an artificial fabric like nylon. So if a woman is brave enough to actually walk around all the time with nylon underwear, that would be one way of dealing with it. A more user-friendly method of dealing with it is that by many opinions, panty liners are also not mekabel tuma. Okay? Yes? I will repeat the question, but first I have to hear it. Okay, so the question was, do I think any responsible physician should be letting the patient know about the risks? First of all, I think any time a physician is giving a medication, they should discuss the risks and benefits to with the patient. That includes antibiotics, hormones, and all kinds of other things. I think in this specific case, when you're using it for a less medical reason, okay, then it's even more obligated to do it. And what I mostly think physicians need to be aware of, and I think it's not, I think they just don't know. I think they really think that if a woman comes to them, she must know 100% what she's talking about, and I'm trying to help her and treat her for her religious needs, so I'll give her what she wants without necessarily thinking it through. But part of that is awareness and women themselves being educated consumers. Yes? Okay, the question was, how common is halachic infertility? And the answer is, nobody knows, because no one has actually done a study to find out. We actually have a grant proposal in, all right? This is one of the cool things about living in Israel. There is actually a grant for issues of halacha and medicine, okay, which we are applying for. In the meantime, we actually got one grant to just keep what I call the halachic menstrual cycle. In other words, to go to a bunch of Torah-observing women and have them record their menstrual cycle, including when they do a hefsek and when they go to the mikveh and stuff like that. Because we have to realize that at this point, everything we know about the menstrual cycle is from the general public. And what's considered your period on a medical level and what's considered still being nidah on a halachic level are not exactly the same thing. And we have no data. So hopefully when we have real data, we'll answer it. Some people have said this, it's 25% because 25% of women have short cycles, but as I hope I explained, that's not the way to find it out, because you could have a short cycle and still ovulate on time. Yes? I can't hear. Right? Okay. So, Yoatzot Halacha were trained to answer questions in Hilchot Nida. Included in that was training in terms of looking at garments as far as colors. Things that are straightforward, we answer. Things that are less straightforward, we go further. But I'm telling you, of all the Vedika cloths that people have brought to me, less than 10% do I send to the Rav. Which further shows what I'm talking about, that 90% of the women who are bringing it to me are bringing things that are so clear-cut, not a problem. All right? Which I think goes back to that a lot of this has to do with better education for women themselves in terms of knowing what they're, you know, what they're doing. Because it would reduce a lot of, you know, a lot of stress, a lot of problems. Yes? We get questions across the board. We get questions starting from, I'm a teenager in high school and I'm writing a paper about, to, you know, I went through menopause 20 years ago and I just noticed some bleeding, which the first answer is, please see your doctor, all right? And then, in the meantime, this is the halakhic issues, but please see your doctor. So we get totally, totally across the board. Yes. Yes. The question was about panty liners.
Right. So white.
Yes. Yes. Now, you know, the issue of the artificial materials and the things that are not mekabel tuma, as I said, it's a matter of halachic debate that there are different opinions and therefore one should find out, you know, which position their rabbi follows, but many rabbis feel that since panty liners are made out of paper, which it's probably not mekabel tuma, and if it is mekabel tuma, it has to do with the fancy library paper, not the stuff that you're throwing in the toilet. On the other hand, it's put together, it's a kli, so maybe it should be mekabel tuma, but on the other hand, it's a vessel, it's a kli that you're about to throw in the garbage, so it doesn't. Okay, so those are the issues of the debate, and if you accept that it's something that is not mekabel tuma, something that cannot get halachic ritual impurity, then it can be white. Because each one of those caveats is separate. Color is one, size is another, ritual impurity is a third, etc. Yes? Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I think women should ask. I think women should go and they should be willing to ask their rabbis. And for women who are not willing to go and ask their rabbis, that is part of the reason why they're Yoatzot Halacha. And there have been 100,000 questions that have come into the Yoatzot Halacha hotline to date. So lest anybody think that this is only a few women, this is a lot. Okay. Black liners. Having the black panty liners is basically you're having two leniencies, okay? It's colored, and it doesn't accept ritual impurities. So that's maybe even better. It's also better psychologically for some women, because some women, even if you tell them 100 times, it's okay, will not believe you. So if it's on black and they don't see it, then they believe you. Yes? Uh-huh. Increases breast cancer. Okay, just like I said, there's a lot of halachic debate. On this, there's a lot of medical debate. But to give you a couple of studies that have at least raised the issue, in the large study having to do with the PremPro using hormone replacement therapy, one of the things they saw when they stopped the study early is that the risk for breast cancer for women who were basically taking estrogen for hormone replacement therapy was increased by 24%. Okay, once again, it's a big percentage, but if you're talking about something that was one in a couple of thousand, and you increased it to 1.25 in 100,000, it's not numerically a lot, but it's a big increase. So, yes. Right. Right, well, it's the same drug, okay? So that's what the concern is. Nobody has actually done a study yet of women who are using these interventions for the purpose of halachic infertility. What is their risk? It's mostly learning it from other uses, okay? And it might be better because this is short-term as opposed to menopause, which tends to be long-term. Or it might be worse because you're giving these to young women whose breast tissue is still developing as opposed to giving it to women who are past menopause who have less breast development. We don't know. No, you know, we just don't know. Mm-hmm. It certainly would raise the issue even more. I mean, I think all cases in halacha have to do with individual decisions, so you can't say for everybody, but there's no question that if a woman comes from a family where there is a high breast cancer risk, then one would be even more cautious in terms of just saying, oh, okay, take the medication, it's no big deal. Yes? Right. Yes. Right. Though AI raises halachic issues for the husband to do it during the time the woman's in Ida. No. I'm not saying about doing the AI itself. I'm saying having the husband being the one to inject it is a halachic issue. Okay? Which one could get away. You're right. There are other things. This could be, a whole day yom yon as opposed to a 1 hour talk, but this was more to get the idea of that. Yeah. Yes. Uh-huh. Okay. So first of all, I think that women themselves should be educated, okay? I'll make a plug for my book, A Lifetime Companion to the Laws of Jewish Family Life, which is a book written on Hilchot Nida, which deals with the halachic and medical issues because I can't differentiate between the two of them. They all go together. The Oetzot also have an online Kala class, which can supplement the individual guidance that one gets and, is a chance to read it. There's asking questions of Oetzot. Okay, we have both a hotline and a website which people can ask lots of questions to. And I was saying, mostly keep asking questions. Don't just take anything as a given. And as far as educating college teachers, I mean, that's part of the idea of the other reason that I'm here. And I'll be speaking at the Yarchei Kala, okay, where there'll be 70 rebbetzins, many of whom are college teachers. And, by word of mouth, things will do. But I think a lot of it really should come from women themselves. Okay, I think we owe it to ourselves to be educated consumers, halachically as well as medically. Yes?
Do you have any questions from men?
Yes. Okay, I would say, 3 or 4%, because I would say that most men feel more comfortable asking about rabbi than a female Yoesef.
Well, I'm not saying, because their wife, if they were
Yes. No. We do. We definitely do. Their wives do ask questions, or we have a number of cases that come through from husbands whose wives, they have become religious, their wives are not religious, and they're, you know, don't know exactly how to deal with it. So we get that too. First of all, like I said, most of the Rebbetzins that are at this conference are Kallah teachers. What? Right. But any time Nishmat is invited to come and speak, they will come and speak. So if you know of another venue in which it would be good to do it, you know, happy. I'm in Israel, but the OSL who are here in America too, who can also give a lot of information. Yeah. Because it's easy. No. Because it's easier halachically to do it, because one is Gzeira and the other is talked about in the Talmud as being halacha psuka. That even though it may have started out as a practice or whatever, it was so universally accepted that that's very hard to deal with. Whereas the 4 or 5 days, the Sfardim keep a lot less of it, and there's a lot, not only in terms of days, but in terms of whether they actually had relationships or they didn't have relationships or stuff like that, so there's more room to play with them. Okay, thank you. You're welcome. A lifetime companion to the laws of Jewish family life. What I really wanted to call it was the book I wanted when I got married. But I got voted down by the publisher.